Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Jakin. With me today is Robert Alter, renowned professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. Alter is one of the greatest living literary scholars and analysts of the Bible. He is the author of some 20 books that cover the gamut from the history of the European novel to contemporary American fiction to commentaries on modern Hebrew literature. He's also received great acclaim for his recent translations of the five books of Moses and Psalms. His most recent publication is Pen of Iron, American Prose and the King James Bible. Alter is coming to Memphis as the keynote speaker for a series of events hosted by University of Memphis and Rhodes College on November 10th and 11th that celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. Robert Alter, thanks for being with us on Counterpoint.
I'm very happy to be here.
Robert, you've been traveling the country a fair bit of late, going to commemorations celebrating the King James Bible.
Yes, I have been.
But the KJV was hardly the first English translation of the Bible, and you point out that in numerous cases, the King James Bible is not accurate to the Hebrew. So why all the fuss? What's so special about the King James Version that it merits all this attention?
Well, let me begin with the question of accuracy, which I don't think we have to linger on. The fact of the matter is that Christian Hebraists in the early 17th century had worked up Hebrew rather impressively, but their knowledge of the language was imperfect. I would say it was not comparable to that of Jewish medieval and early modern scholars. And it certainly was not comparable to that of 20th, 21st century scholars, where we know all kinds of things they couldn't have known, like languages like Akkadian and Sumerian and Ugaritic, which help us understand the Hebrew. So there are glitches, a lot of little ones, and here and there a real howler. But I don't think that we can seriously fault them for this. They did what they could at that particular historical moment. But basically, they had a great sense of English style with some inconsistencies there. And I would say the key to the style is when people ask, how could a committee produce a work of literary genius? Well, they followed, in many respects, the work of a single translator of genius, William Tyndale, who worked in the 1520s alone, who ended up being arrested by the Inquisition, strangled, and burned at the stake for the heresy of translating the Bible. And he never finished. He did parts of the New Testament, parts of the Old Testament, but the parts that he did, they cribbed from very generously, and the parts that he didn't do, they followed his model as a translator.
So if the King James Version is partly distinguished because of the style that they bring to bear on it, and if it's had such an impact on the writing of English literature, then why have you been engaged over the last several years in the arduous process of translating the Bible yourself?
Ah, that's an almost embarrassing question. Put it this way. When I began in the mid-90s translating Genesis as a kind of experiment, I thought, well, there are certain stylistic qualities distinctive of the Hebrew, its use of syntax, its use of repetition, and above all, its use of sound, that nobody has really gotten to. The King James Version maybe is the best approximation, but to take one central instance, they did not pay much attention to the sound of the Hebrew. This might have been in part because they were very focused on getting word-for-word literal good equivalents from the Hebrew to the English, so they didn't pay attention to the sound. It also may be that for them, the Hebrew text was a text on the page to be construed rather than something to be sounded out, rather than something that rang in their poetic ear. For me, the sound is hugely important. To take the instance of poetry, the poetry is built on very powerful, extremely compact rhythms. And I find that as grand as the King James Version often is, not always, in its rendering of ancient Hebrew poetry, it doesn't pay any attention at all to these rhythms. And it will use sometimes 16, 17 words where there are three or four in the Hebrew. And so one of the things that I've tried to do as a translator is to actually approach those powerfully compact Hebrew rhythms and to tamp down the English language to make it feel and sound more like the Hebrew.
So interesting that you say they don't really capture the rhythm and sound of the language, especially because we're talking here about the early 17th century, which was, of course, very much an oral culture. You know, you write of the King James Version, not only is it stylistically beautiful, but you say that, quote, this language articulates a set of values, or perhaps one should say a set of demands and a way of imagining man, God, and history. If this is true of the King James Version, then what values or demands do you think are at work in your translation? Or let me put the question slightly differently. How do you think your translations imagine man, God, and history differently from the King James Version?
Well, I would say this. The King James translators, inevitably, there was no way they could avoid this, viewed both Old and New Testament as God's revealed word, which was a repository of Christian value. So they could not help rendering much of what was going on in the ancient Hebrew world in through Christian terms. I'll give you two examples. The famously and eloquently, I have to say, the King James Version is full of souls. You know, my soul praiseth the Lord, and so on and so forth. Now, there's actually no biblical word for soul. This may shock some people. The word that is rendered as soul means life breath, life, essential person. But why doesn't it mean soul? It doesn't mean soul because the world view of the Hebrew writers was basically a view of here and now. They did not think of an afterlife. They're really a lot closer to Homer in this respect than they are to later Christians and Jews. So when you're talking about soul, you're talking about a split between body and soul, and you're talking about an entity that survives the body, which is flat out against the way that the ancient Hebrew writers conceived the world. So in my translation, I try to get back to the here and now-ness, to the sheer concrete physicality of the biblical worldview.
You said you had a second example of how
Yes, that's salvation. This is one which is going to grate on the ears of people who are used to the canon and the traditional translation. Now, salvation, as we speakers of English know, is a loaded term. If you think of individual salvation, you think of a radical transformation of the individual, or I have to say the individual soul, that will be valid for all eternity. If you're thinking of humankind as a whole, you're thinking, well, some kind of radical transformation of the nature of history, salvation for humanity. The Hebrew word that's rendered as salvation, both the noun and the related verb, actually means to get somebody out of a tight fix, which is very different from salvation. So as much as I love the ring of God of my salvation, I translate it as God of my rescue, because that's really what the psalmist is praying for.
Now, when you talked about the rendering that you're giving to the Hebrew Bible, you made allusion to Homer. And one of your claims in your book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, is that the style of the Bible is bound up with its theology, which is history-centered monotheism that rejects polytheism and its attendant mythological worldview. Since you read the Bible as a literary scholar, can you explain how you do this while at the same time insisting that the Bible is not a mythic story, like the Greek myths or myths from other cultures?
Maybe I should slightly qualify those words that I wrote 3 decades ago. which I have somewhat revised, by the way, not radically, but a revised edition of that book came out just a few months ago. Of course, there are mythic elements in the Bible. I would think that the garden story is rather mythological, although it's not quite mythological in the sense of a story about gods. It is a story about people primarily, although God interacts with people, and he famously walks through the garden at the cool of day, as a person would do. And in Genesis, God is quite anthropomorphic. Afterwards, he becomes less accessible to human beings and less mythic, less anthropomorphic, I think. So this literature was very mythological. These were polytheists, and they had a worldview in which myth was key. And it's hardly surprising that the biblical writers didn't entirely let go of this. There are vestiges and traces of this mythological background. But you have to remember that the Hebrew Bible spans from its very earliest text to its very latest 800, perhaps almost 900 years. So it's almost a millennium. So things change. By the later biblical period, the mythic elements are mostly poetic vehicles in Psalms and in the book of Job, for example. So it's a little bit in this respect like Milton, who was a very good monotheistic Christian, but was entranced by the poetic power of Homer and Virgil, perhaps more Homer than Virgil, and transported that into his poetry.
Robert, let's turn a little bit to the Pen of Iron now. The prelude is called America is a Scriptural Culture. And the argument of the book is that the King James Bible has served as the key script, at least until recently. You write that the 1611 translation determined the foundational language and symbolic imagery of a whole culture, since the pilgrims for a long time and afterwards their progeny were Bible-steeped, Bible-quoting folk. Can you unpack this a little? How has the King James Bible shaped American literary culture and perhaps American culture more generally?
As I suppose everybody is aware, it was Protestantism that put the Bible into people's homes and into their daily lives. That was really part of the pitch that Luther made when he broke from the church. The church hierarchy should not be a mediator between ordinary people and the Bible, but it should be accessible to everybody, which is why Luther translated the Bible into German. And I think that the King James Version was the most successful implementation of this general program of Protestantism because it was readable and it had this literary power. It spoke to people. And certainly in America in the 18th and for most of the 19th century, of course, people were hearing Bible in their churches, but they were also reading Bible at home. The way our kids grow up listening to pop music, and they know the words by heart, the way they relate to the world, people in American homes in the 19th century grew up that way. For me, the preeminent illustration of this is Herman Melville, who grew up in a Dutch Protestant home. Actually, his mother read the Bible in both Dutch and English, but I don't think he was exposed to it in Dutch. So it was very much part of his formative years. Now, Melville, at least as far as one can make out, did not remain anything like a believing Christian once he attained maturity. But when he set out to create a kind of prose epic, which would be an American masterpiece, I mean, of course, Moby Dick, those rhythms and that syntax and that imagery all got into his prose.
And it's not only Melville. You show through the text that it had this kind of influence on a whole range of writers from the 19th through the 20th centuries. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. With me today is Robert Alter, world-renowned scholar of literature and translator of the Hebrew Bible. Alter is the keynote lecturer for a series of events commemorating the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible that will take place November 10th and 11th at the University of Memphis and at Rhodes College. Now, in your readings of Melville, Faulkner, and Bellow, you show that they use the biblical language, as you've been suggesting, both the grammar and the lexicon of the Bible's categories. And what's so interesting in the way you read it is that you show that they do so especially when they are challenging the faith and morality that the Bible teaches. So you say of Melville's Moby Dick, for example, that it's at once profoundly biblical and paradoxically anti-biblical. Can you explain what you mean by this?
The way literary traditions evolve is foundational texts, literary ancestors, are used by later writers. This goes beyond religious texts. They very rarely use them with a total identification with the values and beliefs of those foundational texts. For example, Joyce's Ulysses is famously based in its overall structure on Homer's Odyssey, and yet it's so different. That is, instead of a warrior hero, you have a kind of average, middling, sensual man who is an unsuccessful advertising canvasser who has a failed marriage. Instead of Penelope, the faithful wife, you have an adulterous wife. And instead of revenge against Penelope's suitors, at the very end, Joyce, who was a pacifist, has his hero come to terms with, reconcile with the fact that his wife is unfaithful to him, but she's faithful to him in her fashion. So you see what I mean, that this reversal of values happens all over the place, not just in relation to the Bible. So in the case of Melville, on the one hand, there are things that I would say are anti-biblical. For example, the flood story, which he invokes a couple of times, which ends, as everyone remembers, with God's promise to Noah through the rainbow, never again to bring a flood upon the earth to destroy all living things. Melville quotes this, and he says, "And yet we see that three-quarters of the visible globe is still covered with water, that the flood has not receded." So instead of a world where there is providential promise to humankind, you have a world that seems to be somehow threatening, hostile to humankind. So that's half the story. But the other half, which I find quite interesting, is that Melville chose one particular biblical text to invoke, which in fact is in many ways a dissent from the majority worldview that you see in the biblical writings, and I mean the book of Job. Now, the obvious reason that he chose Job is that you have Leviathan at the end of Job in the speech from the whirlwind, and Leviathan, Melville, for his purposes, chose to understand as a representation of the great whale. So that worked for him. But something more works for him. What the voice from the whirlwind conveys is a radical reversal of a central biblical doctrine. That central doctrine is the man as the pinnacle of creation. You remember in Genesis, the first human being is enjoined to hold sway over all creatures, and he is created last, he and she, I should say, the grand culmination of creation. But in Job, in the voice from the whirlwind, it's turned around. Man sits somewhere up in the bleachers, watching the vast roiling action of the animal kingdom and the play of meteorological forces and creation itself that takes place in the world. So man is actually peripheral in this version. That's a shocking switch, but it's a shocking switch that very much matched Melville's perception of things. So that's the way in which the book of Job enables him to be biblical at the same time that he's anti-biblical.
So let's just take this a little step further, because you've been talking about the ways in which these American writers took biblical categories but then reversed the values of the Bible to offer an alternative picture of the human predicament. With Faulkner, and you're reading of Faulkner, what you suggest about the way in which he writes aspects of the David narrative is that, in fact, it's a deeply insightful commentary on the David story that has oftentimes been missed by biblical scholars. So tell us a little bit about how Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom sheds light on the story of David upon which it's based.
We think, not just we, but I think the biblical writers who wrote the book of Kings after David, that David is the founder of the great divinely authorized dynasty. He is, as a notion of a Messiah evolved for both Jews and Christians, that Messiah is going to be the son of David, the legitimate heir of David. And so one of the Gospels of, I think it's Matthew, draws a direct lineage from David, the son of Jesse, to Jesus of Nazareth. And he's a grand, heroic king, and he is also a pious king. That is, if you think of all those medieval illuminations in which David is playing the harp, David as the legendary author, which he actually was not, of the book of Psalms. But if you look at the David story itself, which to my mind is one of the very great pieces of narrative that came out of the whole ancient world, a very profound and searching representation of a human life evolving through time and of man as a political animal, you see that David is a flawed person. One of his big flaws is a propensity to use women for his own purposes, in some cases political purposes, which is very much like Thomas Sutpen in Faulkner's novel. But the other thing is that with the grand success of the divinely elected dynasty, it's also represented as a kind of failure. That is, after the pivotal event of the adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah, the prophet Nathan, and some people don't always remember this very well, comes to David, denounces him, and the denunciation takes the form of a really ringing curse that says, the sword will never depart from your house, and so on and so forth. Faulkner understood this very deeply. He understood that there is a sense in which the story of the rise of David is also the story of the fall of the house of David. And that's what he does in the Sutpen story. And in the Sutpen story is really a kind of emblematic story of the American South. A man who comes from nowhere, like David, a Sutpen, who comes from redneck stock, who imports a gang of black slaves, builds a mansion that he calls Sutpen's Hundred in the wilderness, and tries to found something like a royal house, but it's all built on slavery, and that's ultimately why it collapses. And the slavery issue is where Faulkner departs from the biblical story, which of course doesn't involve slaves and doesn't involve race. In the biblical story, the great horror is that a brother rapes his half-sister. Amnon rapes Tamar, and then he is murdered in revenge by Absalom, who is the full brother of Tamar. In the Faulkner story, well, yeah, they're also half-brother, half-sister, so it is incest. It's not incest, but it's misogyny that is the great horror, and that brings about the fratricide. The figure who stands in for the biblical Absalom is, I think he's 1/16th African. and that is enough to induce a kind of horror in the Sutpin father and son.
Now, as you've been suggesting in talking a little bit about Melville and Faulkner, I want to sort of pull out a little bit about the significance of the title of your book. Pen of Iron is of course, also a biblical allusion. That is to Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 1, that reads, "The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron." Can you riff a little on the meaning of your title? Why'd you call the book The Pen of Iron? And I want to supplement that question with one that I think's a little bit cheeky. Would it be wrong to suggest that as a son of Judah, there's perhaps a little of the embrace of the sinful in your own reading and commentaries on the Bible, at least as a counterpoint to the self-righteous and reductive readings of the Bible that often inundate our culture?
The Bible, it's a book that has a religious message, for sure, but it's not a didactic book. What makes it great, I think, is that it has a profound sense of men and women in their all their imperfections. And even being elected by God does not change this. I mean, Jacob, after all, who is given the grand name of Israel and becomes the eponymous founder of the people of Israel, is a highly imperfect person. Then we see him in his weakness. We see him as a kind of prima donna of paternal grief. And all this gives resonance and depth to the story, and the same is true of David, and the same is true of many other biblical characters. So I wasn't thinking so much of the sin of Judah part of the quotation. And by the way, that phrase, pen of iron, does occur somewhere else in a different context in the book of Job, where Job asks that his plea in his own behalf, his defense plea before God, be written down with a pen of iron. So it's obviously a poetic metaphor. That is, before we had ballpoint pens or fountain pens, we had quills or a light wooden pen with a metal nib. A pen of iron is something stern and unbreakable and monumental. So for me, it conveys something of the stylistic quality, the strength and assertiveness and the compactness of the Hebrew.
As well as, of course, the profundity and the depth that you help us to explore in works like Pen of Iron and in your translations of the Hebrew Bible and in much else of your writing. Robert Alter, thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Robert Alter will be the keynote lecturer for the series of events commemorating the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, coordinated by Professor Scott Neustock, director of the Pierce Shakespeare Endowment at Rhodes College. These begin on November 9th with the Memphis opening of the Folger Shakespeare Library's touring exhibit of the creation and afterlife of the King James Bible. November 10th at 6 p.m. at University of Memphis, Alter will give his keynote lecture titled The King James Bible and the Question of Eloquence. If you've not attended prior Pierce Shakespeare events, then I can tell you that the highlight is sure to be the symposium on November 11th from 1 to 5 in Blount Auditorium at Rhodes College, where there'll be an open discussion on the King James Bible and its impact, featuring a group of renowned scholars from across the nation, including Robert Alter. And on November 13th, there will be a musical recital with the music of 1611 by Parthenia, a consort of viols. So a celebration for all the senses on the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. For more information, visit the Rhodes College website and search for Shakespeare at Rhodes. For more Counterpoint interviews, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the Counterpoint link listed under the news menu item. Or visit iTunes. Search for Jonathan Judaikin or Counterpoint and sign up for the podcast to be downloaded automatically to your favorite listening device. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.